this funnel a year ago with the presence of some other major charters in the Limassol shipping port capital in Oro, because we decided with the authorities that it would be good to hear also the people controlling the cargo, their opinions for the market, how they see all the changes, and to hear the other voice, and not only ship owners and ship managers and service providers and all that. So I'm delighted to have with us today two very important dry bulk charterers. We have first of all Mr. Mohammed Bin Fatal. He's the president of Bulk Dry, the national shipping company of Saudi Arabia that was established in 1978. A public investment bank of the Saudi government owns 70% of the company. Saudi Aramco holds 10%, the remaining of the shares trade in the Saudi stock park. Bulk Dry, the dry arm of Bulk, which is a fully integrated ship owner and operator of bulk commodities, established in 2010 with focus on Saudi Arabia inbound and outbound cargoes. Headquartered in Riyadh and with a regional office in Dubai, Battery that transports bulk cargoes, primarily grains, fertilizers, coal, iron ore, and other dry bulk cargoes. In 2024, as we achieved the significant milestone by transporting aggregate 6.2 million tons of cargo, and marking a 68% growth over the previous year. Saudi cargo book is growing steady and growth 22 million metric tons by 2032. Bulk is also a ship owner with a modern fleet of 13 owned vessels, including 9 Kamsarmax and 4 Ultramax ships, and fleet expansion is a strategic priority. Their target is quadruple their fleet in the coming years. Also with us is Mr. Robert Schrip from Olam Grain. Olam is a major food and agribusiness company founded in 1989. Olam operates in over 60 countries with over 90,000 employees. Headquartered and listed in Singapore, Olam Group currently ranks among the top 30 largest primary listed companies in Singapore and is a Fortune 500 company. Olam Agri trades about 40 million tons of dry cargo a year and operates a fleet of around 70 dry bulk vessels. Robert Schiff is their senior freight manager operating from Neon, Switzerland. So thank you both for accepting our invitations. Been coming all the way to Limassol, your views on the matter. I will start with Mr. Bin Fatal. From your perspective, what are the most pressing challenges for dry bulk shipping market in the Middle East region, and how is Bari adapting to these challenges?
Thank you very much, Louis, and the beginning, please allow me to be. Thank you, Mercenary, for having us in this period. Also to give us the opportunity to visit this lovely city of Jerusalem. Talking about the challenges in the Middle East, at the end of the day, the Middle East is part of the global network, so what happened within the geopolitics and the trade wars absolutely affect the region. But the region also has its uniqueness. So if we go back to the history, Strait of Hormuz, which is very major waterway for us, has been a channel. And at that time, we thought it is the only channel. I remember in 2014, I was running the container supply chain for the petrochemical giant in Saudi Arabia, SABIC. We used to move like 500,000 TEU a year through the Gulf. And we had a new CEO, and he said, Mohammed, you have a contingency plan for the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. What about Bab el-Mandeb or the Red Sea? At that time, I thought he's being sarcastic, so I said, Would you like me to include the ozone hole also to be closed so we can look into that scenario? And it also, a few years later, that happened, and the Red Sea became a challenge. The moral of the story is that to navigate a challenge, you need to invest before the challenge happens. And for us, we have been living through it, so high water, low water, we've been going through the peninsula at both waterways. By a few things, definitely, I mean, the bidding process, and knowing your counter parties, alignment with the navies and authorities, including. So that's when it comes for the waterways. Other things that we have, we are going through also a transformation where the demand is growing, given those mega events that are going to take place in the region, so a lot to move. And the kingdom also appetite to be an important logistic node on the global trade. So one of the few challenges that we are having is the ports capabilities. For example, the Jubail port cannot handle cape sizes now, so we are missing an opportunity over there. Another challenge that we have is the compatibility with the tonnage. So most of the inbound when it comes to dry bulk is into a geared segment, let it be Ultramaxes or smaller, and the inbound when it comes to grain or Kamsarmaxes. So the triangulation or the full program, you need to work it delicately. So we are trying to find the proper tonnage side. As you mentioned, yes, we have our own tonnage, but we rely heavily on excellent partner like yourself to access the market tonnage and be able to marry those cargoes.
Thank you. Similar question goes to Robert. With the potential shifts in global economic policies, including the return of the America First policies and increased tariffs, how do you foresee the changes impacting the agricultural commodity trade flows and dry bulk shipping demands?
Yeah. Thanks, Paulus. Thanks for having me. Stephanie here for Orlando. It's a great honor to be here. So I think from Angelica's presentation, the conclusion is that there's going to be a lot of uncertainty, and that generally tariffs are bad for both trade. So naturally, that with dry bulk shipping. At this stage, it's still very clear how the tariffs will play out. Is it a negotiation tactic to get the Chinese on the table to buy more US products? Next, notably, also coal. Will there be a framework agreement? And then will tariffs scale back? Or are we going back to a 2018 to oil? If we use 2018-2019 as an example, shipping rates on Panamaxes, actually they didn't really get impacted that much. It was a bit of a wobble at the start, but then freight rates stabilized somewhat, and we don't think that it had a major impact on freight rates, but it did have a major impact on its volatility. Volatility has been exacerbated. We have seen some serious spikes. We have seen some big dips, and these are difficult posts to manage as a trade trade. So, if we assume that China, if we assume for 2018 2.0, we don't think it's going to have a huge impact. And your presentation tends to confirm that. The 10 miles. Are going to be more or less equal. We're going to lose some US Gulf, which is bullish Q4 front door, but we're going to add some 10 miles in Q1 out of Brazil. Maybe there'll be more PNW to China spot. So that is, which is naturally bearish. The net-net, we don't think it's going to be a big impact on Panamaxes. On cape sizes, it's going to be less because essentially there's very little quality spitting out, shipping out of the US. On capes, it was coal, but that's now mainly going to India. And actually, last week, we've seen the first real-time impact of the retaliatory tariffs from China. So we fixed the ship, cleaned up my tractors, Baltimore to China, and as she passed India, we did a 90-degree turn on demand from the charterers because they were suddenly slapped with 15% for the 15% tariff on their coal. So it's happening. It's real. I've seen some messages by the brokers today that there's more of that happening. So that's something to watch. It's slightly negative, we don't think it's going to have a major impact. Tariffs may create inefficiencies, which is great for shipping. Sometimes we see the Red Sea, which is a challenge for you, an opportunity for others. But overall, we don't think it's good for shipping as a whole. And what we think will be certain is that this uncertainty will lead to a huge amount of volatility. And this is something that we have.
Yes, as a ship owner as well, I don't expect a great market this year. You thought it more optimistic, Paul, than you. So I'd have to consult. Going to the question of sustainability and environmental responsibility, I will apply the same question to both of you, starting with the Barry Dry, being an owner as well, and also to work as a major charterer of Barry Dry. So, is there a bit pattern? How is Barry attending the challenges of IMO's in environmental regulations, such as the carbon intensity ratio, and what role do these regulations play in your fleet planning and operations?
Absolutely. The deal I have with the IMO, so we want to remain in business. We need to comply with whatever requires. And on the main challenge is the uncertainty is what regulation would come along with the fleet. So for us, absolutely, we are modernizing the fleet. We are adding energy-saving devices, utilizing the carbon trade systems, and what have you, but I'm sure any ship owner is doing the same. The twist that we are doing is we have a major initiative, governmental initiative called the WAVE. And the WAVE is to call upon the ocean stakeholders, let it be shipping companies, producers, users, divers, individuals, scientists, and academia, how we collectively, in a way that is not pushing the stakeholders, but encouraging them to do what they can do to reduce ocean pollution and encourage the sustainability management of the ocean resources, restoring the coastal ecosystem. And we, as Bethlehem Green Ocean, is all for us, like any ship owner, so we are also proud to be one of the sponsors, and it will be revealed fully in March, a major convention in Miami. We're going to also, I'm sure, the fellow ship owners will find it really adding to their sustainability. That's it, Werner. Thank you.
Offer to view the lot of external environmental sustainability considerations influencing your chartering decisions. What steps are you taking to align with global decarbonization goals?
So I'm going to do a bit of marketing here. OLM has been at the forefront of sustainability throughout its supply chains. It's something that our CEO is really championing. He is, in fact, the chair of the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. And so what we do in practice is that we have certified FSC forestry products out of the Congo. We provide sustainable cocoa in Côte d'Ivoire, sustainable palm in Gabon, to name a few examples. We do that for two reasons. One, it's the right thing to do. We need to protect the environment. Secondly, it makes economic sense. We're actually getting premier rates in our products. So when it comes to chartering, of course, we do take environmental considerations into account. We prefer to fix in emitting quality ships from reputable orders such as Brazil. This is particularly true when you're fixing ships into Europe. We're fixing in lower emitting vessels to reduce our fuel EU and EU ETS penalties, hence reducing our freight rates. Just as an example, in 2025, so today, Kamsarmax that consumes 20 tons per day versus a Kamsarmax that consumes 30 tons per day on the New Orleans to Rotterdam round voyage will save us $40,000 in fuel EU and EU ETS. That is close to $1,000 per day or 60 cents per ton. It's money, especially if you have value in these carbon products. In 2026, that difference will be over 50 yen. So we do take it into account because we think it's important, though we certainly take it into account when it matters to the bottom line. And then there's a whole question around new fuels, which we are not first movers on. I understand you are, but we closely monitor what's being done. We have access to biofuels at the major bunker and hubs, and this is something that we will live up.
Yes, we were early movers, and the question that if the next couple of years it was the right move or not, as I said it before, that I knew more about fuel usefulness 2 years ago, and I ordered the ships that I know today. So, we'll see what happens. So, it's a pin that given your strategic position in the Red Sea and in the Arabian Gulf, as barrier addressing security risks such as piracy, geopolitical tensions, to ensure safe and efficient operations.
Charters, resilience is the name of the game. They need to sleep well at night knowing that their cargo are safely handled and there is no chances it will get the flow corrupted. So for us in order to cope with that, we are adopting a few techniques. One is, indeed, we like third-party ship managers, but we also believe that it will enhance ship management, give you more grip on your tonnage on the tail of navigating those water and complying with the storages and what carry. The others that we are doing, we are trying to be a full solution. So, yes, the name Bahri in Arabic means seas or water. But we are beyond in the total supply chain solution. So, for example, we have a major bonded zone in the Islamic port of Jeddah. We do have also another bonded zone on the airport in Riyadh, a grain terminal in Yanbu'at. In addition to, as you heard about last year in the G20 about the Belt Road through the peninsula to the Mediterranean. So we are trying to use that to give that the client those kind of flexibility, which will provide them with parceling to different techniques. But at the end of the day, I mean, there is some commodities you cannot parcel it, whether it is you don't know grains or coal or what have you. So those we are always committed to navigate those water. And Robert, you mentioned it very well. It is a challenge and opportunity at the same time. So for us, we look at it actually as a liability, if I would say, when it comes to client required. Thank you, yes.
Robert, given the geopolitical instability and lower cargo demand growth, which emerging markets or trade routes do you believe will drive again trade growth in the next 4 years? You may have the geopolitical target there because we all share better market in the first half of 2024 after the Turkish attack while shipping. Followed by also a very bad second half of the year. mainly some things have changed. Something about half of the tariffs that's affecting and protecting the trade markets.
I think it's the weakness of the second half last year and this year is mainly due to the efficiency in China. The turnaround time congestion is so low that despite decent cargo exports, decent cargo numbers, we are just not taking off because there's just too many ships, right? So at least that's my view. But the great demand growth is driven by two things, an increase in population or an improving economic prosperity. Population growth mainly impacts weak demands, as population growth is generally correlated with low income. And so they need a staple diet, and wheat is one of them. So naturally, Africa, given its expected population growth, should be the main growth area. Feed grains, such as soy, corn, are generally correlated to increased prosperity. People have money, that's how they want to eat, and they're consumer oriented, and therefore you need to produce more animals, and therefore you will have high growth in feed grains. We see Southeast Asia and Africa, to a certain extent, also has two main growth areas. We will also see more demand from the Middle East, and Saudi in particular, as they're diversifying their economy and ramping up their own protein production, notably poultry cows, etc. We can talk a lot more about that, Saudi. And then, in terms of just not only demand, but more supply of exports, we still expect growth in South America to continue, notably Brazil. This is more weather-dependent, of course. And finally, if we can reach a peace agreement in Ukraine, and assuming the crops and the yields are the same, we should see an improvement in exports from the Black Sea, but in Ukraine in particular. Although Russia had a record year last year in terms of wheat production, so our forecast is actually for reducing numbers of exports in the West.
Yes, we all know we stopped the discussions in Saudi Arabia. The result of the world bank is what hoping respectively they will increase or decrease the trade flows of the area. It's good to have perfectly well in an unstable place in the Eastern Mediterranean. We also have good news at last to so I post trading the technological innovation. I would ask Mr. Bill about what role do emerging technologies such as digitalization, automation play in enhancing your operational efficiency with safety across the dry bulk fleet?
Yeah, I mean, for the operation of the ship, absolutely, digitalization is more and more providing us with the digital trends. All the vessels, so you are seeing all the vital signs immediately on the spot rather than waiting for an afternoon report, rather than only focusing on the main gauges on board. So you are seeing everything, and it's all about how good the AI logic you're going to build to reach the best output. So we are investing into digital. We believe it is a race that will give better cost structure for all the players in the shipping industry. Although the question is about the operation, I believe in digitalization arena and the shipping on the operation is already recognized as already effort and the step to make it happen. But the other front, the commercial side. You know, we have seen how other industries get disrupted by digitalization from commercial point of view, where the gravity and the grip on the client or the stakeholder is tilted to a digital platform. I believe we owe it for ourselves to start get disrupt before getting disrupted and start applying that. I know that most of us believe that shipping is very classical, very structured industry, and that is a new thing, disruption. But however, I always remind you, look into how Uber disrupted the taxi ride by other things. You wouldn't imagine that an individual with his own car would be able to do the same service. Look how Booking disrupt the hospitality experience, and they tell you who Booking charged 25% local fees. So it is healthy, and if we get under that situation, there'll be a situation where we will not be able to see what the entire market can offer to us.
Thank you. Boy, Robert, what advancements in efficiency technologies are required prioritizing to optimize your charter fleets?
Well, firstly, I was very impressed by your presentation in your office yesterday. The dashboards all over the screen monitoring basically everything within your ships. So that is quite a powerful example of how digitalization has really come to shipping in the last 5 to 10 years. Data collection is clearly key for us. We need to understand how our ships behave in certain trade routes. So we monitor the speed of performance, of course, as detailed as we can. We try and monitor ships we have in period, just to give us a good idea of how they perform and whether sister ships perform in a similar way. So we have a variety of tools that we're using, and that's not even talking about AI and this new advancements, which are basically at grassroots level, and which we are looking at to also help us both with our operational efficiency, but also as a tool to help us trade the market better. On the commercial side, we do a lot of satellite tracking to see where the ships are, to see if there's dislocation of fleets, try and position our ships accordingly, and classical tools such as weather routing optimization, speed calls modeling, et cetera. And I think what's important also is collaboration. I've heard before in a previous presentation, it wasn't AI, it was DHI. I think that's key, that as charterers and owners, we can also work together better in order to decarbonize shipping. I mean, data increases transparency. It's great for our customers. They're asking for it. It's great for the end user. They're asking for it. And I think if there's more dialogue and integration between shippers and owners, don't necessarily have to always try and have the ultimate relationship, then I think we can make a lot of progress.
Well, I agree, and yes, indeed, yesterday we always saw some things we should have said, but anyway, the question of sister ships, sister ship performance, we have 300 people in this audience, whether sister vessels can perform the same, will be 300 take their answers. So it's like children. They are sisters, but they have different
time.
So, going on the final question, because I would like the audience to get involved and ask some questions, because we don't often get our charters here. To part with Riot, the question is, with new building prices potentially declined or are declining, let's agree, does Bali see an opportunity to secure cost-effective vessel or charters or invest in betting more than a fuel efficient vessels?
You're actually coincided, so we are cumulative to grow the fleet size as we used to buy. We are aiming for about 30 ships by the year then 2013. Well, and to do so, absolutely, we need to try the area plus some of the new building devices. Due to it, we have the a new shipyard to be in the kingdom, the second largest in the gate goods, so that would be 1 million. Second is also overseas. We are also aiming to build it overseas. Other challenge that we covered earlier in the financial balance is also the accessibility to find that having a discount ways and techniques and perhaps creating a fund or token that either have a shop mechanism for my financial instrument to make it. But the bottom line, we had a plan to go, and luckily crystal ball is saying the market is going down, so it is a good time to say to tell about that.
Well, I think one question, like we briefly mentioned yesterday, are there plans for Saudi Arabia to invite the ship repair industry also even attempt to enter the shipbuilding stage?
Yeah, absolutely. So the shipyard is a joint venture with Saudi entities, which is Saudi Aramco and Bahri, and the technical partner is the HHI, or the IMTLAC. Also, Lampre, because it is building rigs and jackups. They started 2 years ago by building rigs. This year, they will capture the first immersion bowl ships. We are starting with the dry bulk Ultramaxes, their size of 11 ships for delivery within 2 to 3 years.
And thus, Robert, final question for you, please. With increased volatility expected, the market for strategies is all I'm employing to ensure long term resilience and capitalize on merchant trades.
So, volatility is often seen as a negative word. We as traders, it's an opportunity, low volatility. But over the past few years, we have seen a bigger influx of financials and funds with large higher power in the FA markets. And as fundamental traders, this is also a risk for us because they're distorting our models, they're distorting our views. So as a result, we are taking smaller positions because it's difficult sometimes to understand market moves. However, if we have a very strong conviction in a certain market direction, then we'll, of course, put bigger position on. As a general rule, I think we shrink our positions a little bit more cautious, also with what's going on in the geopolitical world. But this is, volatility is also an opportunity for you as owners. You get spikes in the market which are completely distorted from fundamentals. Happened a few times a year. This allows you to lock in your ships at overly inflated numbers sometimes, provided you have a close in the chart parties and that's great.
Yes. It's true that the ship always make their living from spikes. We have 6 or 7 minutes remaining on purpose. We make it, we have a lot of time. We have in the audience many ship owners and shipping companies that would like to raise some questions. I was not very present with the panel, and Liz will welcome my questions.
We find that sometimes our ships are ordered by the charterers to go at full speed, and obviously the consumption is higher, CO2 emissions are higher, and then we get to the port, and there's already congestion waiting. Then can't the charter coordinate that so that you don't waste all that fuel and the CO2 emissions and make it more efficient?
Yeah, so it's a very good point. Sometimes it makes absolutely no sense. You know, there was a discussion about virtual NORs. And I haven't heard anything since. It's true that as a supply chain, we need to basically sit together to try to optimize this. But at the moment, until that we have
We've got kind of their vision weather routing and all congestion data.
As you know, using the same?
We are. So what will prevent you from optimizing the port
experience?
Assume you have a Brazil to China cargo of beans, and you're ballasting the ship for Singapore, and then suddenly she's hitting bad weather in Cape Good Hope. It's often too late to swap ships around, or you have the same ships that can make the same dates stuck in the same spot. So, of course, we have no interest in burning more fuel and spending more money, but because we have, it's a very fragmented supply chain, and if your supplier, commodity supplier, says you have to come by this date, especially in the US Gulf, and you don't make that date, you're faced with extension penalties, which will cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars. So often we have no choice but to do that.
That's this. Hi, thank you very much. It's always interesting to hear the chat voice because we are both the owners, and only thank you for organizing this very interesting panel here after the year. I have a question regarding pooling. Are you considering to do pooling for the fuel EU issue? And how are the discussions with owners on that issue?
We are having some experience with pooling. We have done it on the tanker side. And, back in the days, it was a matter of arbitrage and more position. But as you said, today maybe it's good for the carbon footprint overall. However, so far, on the drive up, we are not doing pooling. However, we are doing somehow alliances with some ship owners where they access our tonnage and we access their tonnage in a framework agreement rather than a voyage by voyage or a time charter by time charter.
I think he was mostly referring on emissions, pooling, not the conventional.
So for us, we're not there yet. We're looking at options. What is our best options to do so? Pooling is certainly one of them because we don't actually have the ships that are offsetting the emissions yet. So we will need to at some point do so. It's quite complex. So we're taking our time to really kind of make the right decision on that.
We have time for two more questions. Please, Constantine.
Thank you very much for your listening presentations and talks. Are there any criteria, either commercial or technical, based on which you contribute to the investment that the ship owner is thinking to do on board his vessel for making it more efficient?
So we've had these discussions and we've invested with some ship owners together, so profit sharing on future investments, so yeah, absolutely.
What about Bahri? Do you have any?
Well, I mean, for us, we are a hybrid model, so we are a ship owner and operator. Never done it in the past, but we are thinking now as perhaps, I mean, if we are taking a long-term charter for a new build that we align it up front with some of a ship owner, we could consider so. Over existing, the fleet, we believe we can do whatever advancement on our own tonnage.
Thank you very much.
It's a very good question you made, Constantinos, because this is a win-win question. It's all ship owners, I think, are interested in doing things with their charterers. Of course, the charter cannot be 5 months, 6 months. It will have to be
2 or 3 years to make sense. Right now the market is very low, so this sort of charters, they don't make sense for ship owners. So this question will come in the next year. In next year, as panel here, we will make this question more important. Also, I have a final question to make. I know Holland is using a lot in their operations, you are using a lot the FFA market. The FFA market, and I know Barry may be using it or may not be using it, you have ships as well, a bit of cargo. But how representative do you think are the FFA values? For me as a ship owner, sometimes I get very skeptical because it's a tool that is used against ship owners most of the time, and many charterers asking me to reduce my rate because the FFA market for next year is this and the year after is this. I say, guys, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the FFA market is the level at which a freight trader of one company is selling the market to another freight trader of another charterer. So the owners are very little involved. How do you think this could change in the future? Would owners become more involved to have more active market?
It's a tough question. I think we probably need more owners in the FFA market to make it more liquid and to make it probably more realistic. If you think it's if it doesn't reflect the true values of the future market, I think there's, again, ship owners also benefit from the FFA market when locking in their ships, like I mentioned before. So it is a tool which we use basically to hedge ourselves. If I sell cargo to my soybean team in October, I'll sell it at the equivalent FFA value, plus minus a premium depending on seasonality, route, etc. So for me, it's a very useful tool to manage my risk. Is it going to reflect the future, the levels in Q4? Probably not. But I'm hedged, so I don't really care. I just try and fix under the premium that I sold, and that's how I make money. So it is distorted. It is a very kind of strange animal, in a way. But for us as traders, it's essential, because otherwise we can't manage our risk.
Indeed, we had some experience with the FFA, and actually we've done it when we were mainly more tilted to the operator side. I see it coming, frankly speaking, as Robert said, from trading houses. And I tell you, for me personally, in another capacity, I sit on a grain trading company. So I see it very efficient when it comes to hedge your commodity itself, whether it is corn or soybean. Even barley, you cannot hedge it. You need to do some correlation with other commodities. So for us, when shipping, as ship owner, we hear always about it. This is hedging, you're going to eliminate your risk. But I tell you, look at the major operators. They claim that they have a paper disc, a hedging disc, and that's it. And they were all below the sea level last year. So if that was very effective for a tonnage operator, it would pay off for them. Thank you.
Yes, I think interesting replies from both of you there. I think from an honest point of view, to get involved and increase the volume and have real market meaning, owners must get involved as well in this trade. The only way that owners will get involved is if we raise the barriers. Whatever traders are changing, are agreeing that the market is, we have to add $3,000 a day. $3,000 a day, and then the volume will come in. The volume will come in. So, with this closing remark, I want to thank very, very much our guests from Riyadh, from Saudi Arabia, from Geneva, for coming all the way to Cyprus and meet the Cypriot and the Greek shipping community, and sincerely appreciated your contribution to the success of this conference. Thank you very much.